IVM. Hello, hello, we're Team Splainer. Welcome to an all-new episode of Press Decode, a weekly podcast where we take Splainer's mission to decode the news one step further. Check out our newsletter for more stories and follow us at Splainer In to keep up with all the fun things we plan for our Splainer fam. So sit back, relax, and don't let the news give you the blues. I'm Sarah, your host for the day, and we have a full house with Vagda and Prafulla. As always, we have three segments for you. In our big story, we're looking at the what and why of cultural appropriation, given that Coachella, aka the Mecca of Boho Chic, is back after a pandemic hiatus. For the food for thought segment, we're talking about the politics of veganism and fake meat eating and whether we can truly separate it from the politics. And then in our final segment, we will be roasting and toasting our fave and least fave items from the week. Okay, so now on to our big story. In case you missed it, or I don't know, are a regular Indian who couldn't care any less. Let me tell you that Coachella is back. It was on a 3-year pandemic-induced hiatus, but last weekend it was back. It is a music festival that's held over 2 weekends in California, so it goes on till the end of this upcoming weekend. Now, as much as the music is important to the music festival, it is also the fashion identity that the event has built for itself that seems to make headlines every single time. It did to the boho chic aesthetic what Vodafone or Hutch at the time did to pugs. So, you know, entirely overrated, oh so popular, and borderline harmful. So think feather hairdresses, bindis, nuts, mang tikkas, and just tad bit too much of everything lace and crochet. Oh, and yes. Every single thing has to be paired with boots and boots alone. It's bizarre. And weirdly enough, thanks to the pandemic, I haven't been to any, but music festivals in India and the fashion is a whole other conversation. So yeah, clearly Coachella has been called out for cultural appropriation. And it doesn't help that the festival's reputation includes the fact that the look of choice for every A-list celeb that makes it there is toned-down fashion coupled with a healthy sprinkling of cultural insensitivity. We've had the queen of Coachella, aka Vanessa Hudson, prancing around pairing ponchos and maxi dresses with bindis. A Kendall Jenner showing up in a nut and whatnot. But while all this made me understandably uncomfortable, it also got me thinking about understanding what actually counts for cultural appropriation. I mean, we do wear clothes from across the country, and so where's the line? And to begin with, like, what the hell is cultural appropriation? And why do some acts seem especially unethical and exploitative when compared to others?
I'm just gonna throw a generic definition at you of what is cultural appropriation, and that is the unacknowledged or inappropriate adoption of customs, practices, ideas, etc. of one people or society by members of another and typically more dominant or dominant people or society. And it's often done without giving adequate compensation to the source community for their usage or resulting in the perpetration of negative stereotypes. Now, it's all like up in the air. I doubt anybody understood anything. So I'm just going to go with examples because that's just easier. So let's take this example from 2018 when Christian Dior was accused of taking from an Indian designer brand, People Tree. These People Tree folks had designed a dress with a block print, some sort of yoga pose. Okay. And the same, exact same color and print showed up in a dress by Christian Dior, worn by Sonam Kapoor on a magazine cover.
Reminds me of like high school, right? When someone tried to copy your homework, they're like, at least kuch to change karo na, that the teacher doesn't know. little effort.
Yeah, no, they didn't do shit. But later they reached an out-of-court settlement is what I know. So, and there was a non-disclosure agreement inbuilt in that out-of-court settlement. So we don't know what else happened. The next case is from 1994, which concerns Disney. That shows that they caught hold of the Swahili term Hakuna Matata and trademarked it for themselves. They got a trademark for Hakuna Matata, which means don't worry about it. Basically, the Swahili all is well. But how can you imagine getting all is well as a trademark? It's only Disney who can get to do that.
That's true.
Then there's another 2018. It was really some case for, you know, cultural appropriation. Another case of Fab India using Naga-inspired ornaments and motifs without giving any credit to Naga people was also something. They had clearly used very, very, very explicitly Naga motifs in their prints and called the dress Dobby print dress.
Excuse me?
What is a Dobby?
Isn't Dobby a character in Harry Potter?
Yes.
Okay, I don't know anything more than that, but it was not Naga and that is not cool. Now we come to, that's about businesses. So I have another example of like celebrities. So in my opinion, all of these like business cases seem pretty much negative cases, like cases that needed to be called out, in my opinion. But I now I'm coming to a case where I don't know where I sit. And that's about like this example of Adele wearing Bantu knots and a Jamaican flag bikini top a few years ago, I think in 2019. And she got called out left, right and center for not reading the room. She was apparently going to a celebration of the Jamaican culture in London. And she wore this with a feather headgear and these Bantu knots. And she didn't take it off. At that time, she didn't find anything problematic in that. But later, like a few years later, I think she said, oh, I didn't read the room. I'm sorry. But I also didn't remove it because I didn't want to pretend like it didn't happen. It would mean like I'm erasing it. So yeah, okay, I made a mistake. But I honestly still don't know why. I mean, I understand that I'm not Jamaican. I'm not black. I'm not British. I'm not white. So I'm probably not concerned. And that's why I don't understand. But if she did and she got called out for it, I don't know. And she apologized for it. So I guess good for her and for the people who were offended because it worked out for them, right? That's about celebrities. But now let's come to like regular people, like you and me who wear like things from the rest of the country, you know. And have you been to a spa recently?
Not since the pandemic.
I haven't either. But like from what I remember, what spas used to look like, they were very, very much about like this Buddha aesthetic.
Yes. Only then, right? Can your chakras open.
Like, I don't understand where, like, when you put busts and statues of like Lord Buddha for aesthetic purposes, is that cultural appropriation? The prayer flags or like any kind of memorabilia that people, you know, bring back from their travels. If I went to Leh and I brought back prayer flags, I'm not Buddhist, and I put them in my balcony, am I culturally appropriating? I don't know.
That is the gray area where even I fall in, where I don't know where, how far am I appropriating other cultures. But fun fact about the prayer flags that is sort of related. A lot of people put it within like closed doors, so inside your room or inside your car. And that is explicitly wrong. So it's supposed to be in the open air. So that the whole concept is like the prayers from the flag can just go out into the universe, yeah, etc.
But also tell me, the prayer flags that are being put in cars are being sold in Ladakh by Ladakhi people. So
that's like capitalism. Everyone falls prey to it. So I don't know. Again, it's very gray. I don't know where I stand, but it's like, okay, so you know, culturally, this is what's supposed to happen. But now if I'm helping a Ladakhi person, if like the money, not helping as much as, if the money is going to the right place, then is it so wrong?
So long as the person making the particular artifact that you take back with you, say on your travels, is the local who believes in that or is from that culture, it's okay. So say someone in Rajasthan makes those prayer flags and I buy it, that's not okay.
Yeah, I mean, in Rajasthan, you shouldn't be buying it anyway.
Yeah, but for like aesthetic purposes, if I want to buy, that's definitely cultural appropriation, is it?
I think that's where I would stand right now.
Right? Have any of you ever had like dream catchers, that whole phase of tapestries and things?
Yeah.
Guilty as charged.
So again, I think it's the same concept as a prayer flag, but that one was called out because I think they need to be made in a specific way by specific people in that community. So a mass-produced dream catcher would then be cultural appropriation, I guess. But if you're buying something like a Ladakhi prayer flag, it's made with the specific purpose of being a prayer flag, no matter who it's being sold to, right? So
But it's being made to be put in cars, which was never the intention. The small one, the tiny one that comes specially for your car. Okay, I don't know. I don't know where to draw the line. It's very
best capitalism. We should just leave it at that.
So as long as capitalism is benefiting the culture,
there's only so much you can fight capitalism as much as you'd want to.
So this is where we don't fight capitalism. Is this where we don't fight capitalism?
Oh no.
You know, but I think regardless of whether it, who it benefits, culture is fluid. It's not something that is sitting in a museum and it's limited. It's dynamic. It changes. So some people argue that mixing is where great art happens and it should be encouraged. So I don't know. I still don't know.
Yeah, but I guess also, you know, it's prayer flags are very different from outfits at Coachella, right? Like the war bonnets that people wear. I remember reading about it like in 2017 when this whole thing actually became like, cultural appropriation. That the first of all, they're not like accurate reproductions. They're just, it's based off of different cultures. So it's first a mishmash. And then second, that only like the warriors or the chiefs of those communities or tribes wear those. So again, wearing that as a costume to a music festival of all things, that, I mean, is... Oh, and I also read in Teen Vogue that one person at Coachella was wearing a hijab as an accessory because she thought it was pretty.
Oh, Lord.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be pretty.
It is pretty, no doubt about that. But the whole concept of the hijab versus what you're wearing, like your festival clothes plus a hijab is because we know festival clothes are not
We have all these Hindi comedy movies that where the guys want to hide and they wear a burqa and they move about in the movie.
That is a completely different type of insensitivity, no?
Indian movies and comedy tropes and the insensitivity there is... The level of insensitivity is beyond something that I can comprehend.
Yeah, but you know, I think like it's the hijab thing brings me to like power dynamics of who is an appropriator versus who is an appreciator. Because like even in the States, you're wearing a hijab because it looks pretty to Coachella. You're making a fashion statement. But if you're wearing it normally...
Oh, you're oppressed. Let me come save you.
You're oppressed. And you do that in India, you're not going to get entry into a lot of places. So I think also like we tend to call out... I mean, I guess white people do it more or like the West does it more. I don't know. I couldn't find a lot of examples specifically of India. But I think we just tend to call out people in the West more about their ignorance because like the Coldplay video, what is the song called? Him for the Weekend?
Yes.
That was like a major point of outrage at one point in time, right? And I didn't think much of it. Did you guys?
Same. Right? Okay, finally I found someone else who thinks the same way. I didn't much care.
It felt like another representation of what Americans see certain parts of India as. I didn't feel like it was appropriation at all
It wasn't even in. I mean, you're appropriating if it is India. This wasn't even like a nearly.
That's true.
It was just a lot of color and God knows what.
Didn't they shoot it somewhere in like Banaras or something? No?
I'm not sure.
Anyway, but like, I'm not sure. Like, I don't know if we're going around in circles, but then you see a very clear, I guess, Coldplay did it respectfully. Like, they didn't objectify people if they were wearing, like, traditional clothing. Or they didn't make the whole holy scene a big, like, color run type situation that people seem to think it is. So, I mean, they did benefit off of it, definitely. But I guess that's also different because, like, they did like mention, you know, we wanted to show the culture and stuff like that. There's a lot of brands who will appropriate something or pick up prints or different techniques of making a dress. And not mention it until they are called out for it. And then they will say, you know, this was meant to be tribute to this culture. Recently, I think the Mexican government called out a fashion label, Carolina Herrera, I think, for appropriating prints of one indigenous community in Mexico. The statement that came out after the government said, hey, this is not right, was that the very white creative director said this, that, you know, this entire line brings out Mexican influences, it is Mexican to its core, something like that. I'm paraphrasing majorly, but they didn't think to like say it when the label came out, right? So, and we see this in music always, like Black culture, the way people dress, the way people talk, the Indian rap scene, just absolutely full of such things, right? And do you guys remember anything from Bollywood? Because I tried looking. There were people associated stereotypes to like appropriation. I didn't actually find a lot of examples apart from Chandni Chowk to China, which has left apparently has left an impression on me, because as soon as I read the name, I remembered watching the film on TV and it was very unsettling. But no, do you guys remember anything from Bollywood of the sort?
Not particularly, but it's also because I think a lot of the appropriation in terms of like Asian culture, mm-hmm, and African culture in Bollywood happened, I think, towards the 80s more,
yeah,
so than
it's more
now.
Like older movies.
Which is why I don't have great recall value for that.
80s? No, I mean, I think it was like 70s or something, you know? Sayonara. I remember that song. Do you guys remember that song? Sayonara. Something of that sort.
No,
I have no idea about this.
Literally never heard of this before.
I think this one is from the 50s. I'm not sure of the dates at all. Do not count me. I have no idea about the date. But Chin Chin Choo, you have heard Chin Chin Choo,
yes,
right?
Yes, that I have heard.
Yeah, huh. So there's that.
So somebody pointed out, I don't know if any of y'all have seen Lakshmi Bomb, but apparently in one song in that movie, people are wearing Arab dresses and they're in front of the Burj Khalifa.
Of course.
And I was like, I'm not sure if this is like a stereotype or if this is appropriation.
Yes.
You know?
And then there's a lot of like cringe comedy type of that genre in India that has all of these terribly done African folks.
Oh, yeah. That's true. Oh, blackface. Always.
Yes, blackface. Even 90s, I think Sridevi movies had that a lot.
Huh. Isn't there some song or something where Anil Kapoor is in blackface and Sri Devi is dressed as like, so is she supposed to look like she's Chinese, right? I don't know if this is like a theme with Sri Devi movies or what, but
R.I.P.
Yes, that. No, but
there's Mogambo's villains. Oh, and Mr. India, the Hawa Hawaii song, that one also.
I can't remember what the song looked like.
Mm. Okay, go back and look at it.
Yeah, but Mogambo's villains, I didn't know I remembered all of this so vividly. But, you know, it's interesting because it's not just, I mean, we see it in our day-to-day lives we think of it as entertainment. But then our supreme leader goes and does it also. There was this one time he was wearing a Manipuri stole and then he used that gamcha as his mask.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, I think I remember this.
Right. I think it was one of the Man Ki Baat broadcasts or something. And he used that as his mask. After that, like the demand for that sort of shawl, a stole, I think, grew drastically. And I mean, it's made in a certain way in Manipur and Assam. But it was being mass produced in UP factories.
Oh.
With polyester.
Of course.
Because wow. Modi ji wore that. I understand going to a place and, you know, wearing something as a sign of respect. But when he went to Ladakh and he wore that entire, like, there are pictures of him wearing a traditional gown, but it is completely gold. And he's wearing the headdress and stuff. And I don't know if somebody, a Ladakhi person, actually made that outfit, because I have never seen pictures of somebody like a Ladakhi person wearing something so gaudy. Not bright, but gaudy.
Okay, I'm still stuck on the Modi gamcha. I think like now what used to be once the Nehru jacket is the Modi gamcha. It's just sad.
Yeah, the worst part about it was, you know, demand is growing, so let's mass produce it using polyester.
Ridiculous. That is ridiculous.
So clearly that's our line, right? As long as you're appreciating a one-off thing,
yeah,
it's not so wrong. When it becomes full-blown capitalism, you have lost track of where the culture came from. It's clearly appropriate.
No. Let's not say this. We were okay with capitalism till the time it was us wearing things from the rest of the country. I am...
You lose track of where it came from. Important.
Yes. Okay.
The source of popularity right now is not the tradition, right? The source of popularity right now is, oh, Modi ji ne pehna.
So as long as... No, one second. Whenever cultures... not mainstream cultures are mainstreamed, and which usually happens with like bigger brands when like big celebrities kind of like, you know, take it, and whether or not they give credit. In this case, obviously, when Modi went to Manipur or Assam, whichever trip it was, he wore it there. And it was very clearly part of the culture of those people.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's not his fault that it becomes popular and then after a while, like, lost all sense of belongingness to a particular culture. It's just a thing that Modi does.
Hmm.
Okay, I'm still a little bit confused. And when I find myself confused, I come back to law. Okay? Because it just like grounds me, I think, in my understanding of where what should fall. And because this is cultural appropriation, it kind of falls in the realm of intellectual property law and ideally would be dealt under copyright law. At least, let's say for the Christian Dior example, you know, that's clearly copyright. But when cultural appropriation is about taking from a culture that is not created by one person, in this case, I mean, in Christian Dior's case, it was clearly made by People Tree or Arijit Sen. It can be traced back to them. But like other things like this Modi Gamcha now is something that belongs to a culture. You can't really give copyright or have copyright because there's no one owner. So in like in intellectual property law, there is an umbrella term for this, which is called traditional cultural expression. And the term is very vague and includes like everything from like traditional knowledge, which is, you know, the antiseptic qualities of turmeric. It's very Indian. But that a company in the US tried to patent a few years ago.
What? Did what?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I knew turmeric lattes, but I didn't know they were patenting it.
They were trying to. And that's when like this became a movement here in terms of like traditional knowledge being protected under IP law. And then it could also include folklore. So traditional knowledge is one thing, and traditional cultural expression, the umbrella term, would also include something like folklore. And internationally, the law is overseen by WIPO, which is World Intellectual Property Organization. And there are some international treaties that oversee the performances of, say, traditional songs and music. But the rest is on country laws, which depends on whether you have or you don't. We have a copyright law, but I don't think it covers traditional cultural expression specifically. New Zealand, for example, has protected its indigenous art by giving it trademarks. So if you come to me asking whether something can be legally protected, what I will safely say as a lawyer, it depends.
So our in-house lawyerly nerd gave us some sort of "it depends" kind of closure.
Yeah.
Oh, but guys, what do you think about the several hats of the Prime Minister? Have you seen pictures from his Northeast trips?
Yes. What do I think? It depends.
Shout out to the hats. On that note, we come to the end of our first segment. We'll be right back after a short break. You're listening to Press Decode on the IBM Podcast Network. Hello and welcome back to Press Decode on the IVM Podcast Network. We're Team Splainer, and today's food for thought, we're looking at food. So we're looking at the politics of fake meat, veganism. Now, I'm sure you must have come across a headline here and there about the latest innovation in plant-based meat or fake meat. From McDonald's to Burger King to Subway to KFC, most brands, at least in their US-based stores, have attempted to incorporate this new phenomenon into their menus. So you have the Impossible Burger and whatnot. A report from 2021 showed that 3% of all retail packaged meat sales in the US are plant-based. And $3.1 billion were raised in investment in the alternate protein industry in the same year. So it's clearly not just a fad. I mean, there is money and it is growing at a whirlwind pace, but why and how? And it isn't new, right? So the US has seen veggie burgers since forever. And back home in India, you've always had the vegetarians proclaim down from like buildings, soya chop is vegetarian chicken. So
but it is delicious. I mean, I'm not okay. vegetarian, yes. but I still like it.
I accept. Okay, so honest confession, 22 years of my life, I shunned it saying, nay, nay, I to eat the real deal. What is this? Recently ate it on a trip and good Lord, I missed out. It is delicious.
It is.
But here's the difference, okay? These products were marketed for vegetarians wanting to get a sense of meat in their food. Okay, like what is the hype about, etc., etc. And goes to the extent of I was very, very amused to see that the soya chaap menu is in Jaipur of all places was like keema kaleji and Afghani tikka and whatnot. I was very, very amused. But the difference now, okay, than from this veggie burger, soya chaap range of vegetarian meat products is this fake meat is now marketed to meat-eating customers, basically aims to replace their meat purchases. Why would they do that now? So number one is, I saw the most interesting reason, I feel like that's the reason everyone should jump on, is the pandemic, based on most studies right now, we can fairly conclude, started off in a live meat market in Wuhan. So it saves you from the dangers of that comes from like eating livestock. Then there's health, which apparently meat is unhealthy. I mean, we've all heard about like cancer and fat and whatnot. So yeah, I mean, eating vegetables should be fairly healthy. And then there's sustainability. So the pandemic argument, I don't much want to refute. Now, as an ardent meat eater, the only positive side I found was that plant-based meat isn't actually particularly healthy. I mean, it is safe, even though it is lab-based. It isn't like, it can help you avoid, say, the cancer risks of red meat, etc. But other than that, it is majorly processed. So obviously not entirely healthy, but they're pretty much as healthy as the meat they're replacing. So there isn't much of an argument here in terms of one is healthier than the other. But on the other hand, the one argument that is pretty solid is in terms of the environment, which is where a lot of my personal meat-eating guilt, you know, lies. I'm aware of this. So meatless meat can actually make a huge difference when it comes to the environment in terms of land use, water use, and in like overall fighting climate change. Livestock cultivation is actually one of the most greenhouse gas intensive activities out there in the world. Almost 15% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions comes from this. So yeah, obviously switching would mean lower carbon footprints. And to put it into more numbers, while they use 7% less water and 96% less land, apparently pretty much tastes the same. And overall, a beef burger and a plant-based meat burger has apparently 89% difference in carbon footprint. So clearly there is very, very clear change and difference that can be seen if you switch to meatless meat in terms of the environment, if nothing else. So there is a market, and we've all heard of Beyond Burgers and Impossible Meat. And then, of course, down here in India, we have Imagine Meat by Janelia D'Souza and Ritesh Deshmukh. But then why hasn't it caught on as much?
Well, there might be many, many reasons for why it hasn't caught on. But one of the reasons that really caught my eye was, I was reading this piece in the Wall Street Journal about a brand that sells plant-based meat burgers, Moon Burger. It's located in upstate New York, that is trying to distance itself from the politics of plant-based meat. All the stuff that you clearly mentioned, all of the arguments that are in favor of the plant-based meat, it's trying to move away from all of those arguments. And it's aimed at meat eaters who just want to eat a good burger, you know?
Fair
and
enough.
Those who want to help the environment, but in a non-preachy way. And I found that very, very interesting because generally, yeah, brands do try to remain apolitical because it helps them. And it makes sense because the founder of the Moon Burger, the brand said that his menu doesn't feature polarizing terms like environmentalism, vegetarianism, veganism that can play politically or turn off carnivorous crowd. Now, I don't see that happening in India, but it's truly polarizing in the West. So much that I read a fantastic long read in The Guardian, which was literally titled, "Why Do People Hate Vegans So Much?" And it really does a great job of explaining what this polarization looks like and where it comes from. It speaks of how vegetarians and vegans in Western society, and vegans in particular, experience discrimination and bias similar to levels experienced by like minorities, other minorities. And some of it comes from vegophobia, which is a term that was coined by sociologists in 2011. And it basically showing how the media consistently portrays vegans in a negative light. And why?
If the lawyers can say, well, it depends. Sociologists will always come up with a term, come what may.
Look, I understand why. I mean, I'm not on their side, but I understand why it's coming, because veganism as a movement is controversial. Like, it's trying to confront people's daily life choices, your food and your dietary habits, the way you live. If you dub people or try to make them feel like they're criminals, they are very much going to get defensive and call you all kinds of things, call you annoying. They're going to call you humorless. This is stuff that people have actually called other people, that they vegans should be punched in the face. This is stuff like the stuff that
That's
I read
excessive.
In The Guardian. Yes. And whatever else that people call vegans. But for vegans, of course, this cannot be a way of life. Like, it's a very cyclical argument. So it's people will get defensive because you're criticizing their way of life. But for vegans, it's not really a way of life. You can't have a choice in that. Or can you? I mean, that's the key thing in my opinion, that in the affluent West, which is where this kind of politics is polarizing, eating meat is a choice. And if it remains a choice and you attack people for it, you are bound to get some sort of backlash. But that's just one. The other kinds of political views around veganism are also about appropriation. Now that it's become sort of like a social fad, some people argue that it's being appropriated by people without the politics, which is exactly this plant-based meat burger. You're vegan, but you don't want the politics that comes with it. Others say that the movement has literally been whitewashed because older traditional cultures that have advocated for veganism are sidelined, like Jainism, for example.
And it's interesting that you would bring up, you know, the point of choice, because vegetarianism in India and veganism in India is so different. Like, the polarization over food is so, it does a complete 180 to what it is in the West. And I really can't speak about veganism here except for the fact that to be completely plant-based here, at least, you still have to be mindful of the sort of carbon footprint that comes along with it, because, you know, there's a lot of ingredients that people use in their regular plant-based diets that you won't necessarily get here. But coming to vegetarianism, there's a whole argument about how, you know, vegetarian food habits stem from being protectionist of animals and not because it is a religious tradition. And I'm not sure how recent this was, but I've been seeing this discourse online for the last few weeks now. Like, some people, I've seen instances of like people telling people's anecdotes of saying, you know, I was eating at a restaurant and a vegetarian person completely took offense. Obviously, these are outliers. But a vegetarian person completely took offense and yelled at me for eating in a restaurant, in a public space. And there was a picture doing the rounds where in an office, they had two microwaves labeled, one for meat, one for not vegetarian food. And the person who posted it captioned it, "Live and let live." So I understand if that was there, you know, because of a Jain employee or somebody. But otherwise, like, I don't understand this whole thing of...
Anecdotally, in I studied towards the end of my high school, like middle school and high school in Delhi. I've had this. So I've carried like chicken rolls for tiffin since I can remember.
Same.
But one of my Jain like classmates took extreme offense to my tiffin, and it was like a wash your hands and sit here and sit there. And I, like, I was in seventh grade and I hadn't actually encountered this before. And then for almost a year and a half, I was telling my mom, like, oh, do you know what? Don't send this, you know, it's, I don't want to get into this natak. And later I was like, that was bullshit. That was clearly some bullshit.
Yeah, I don't know how many people have had this in the South, but growing up here in the North, I've had this my entire school life. After a point, classmates got used to it, but it still used to be like, there's chicken in the lunchbox today. And there'd be like this certain distance that wouldn't be there on other days, which is so weird because it's not like we're a meat averse country. Like biryani was the most ordered food on Swiggy last year. Like the statistic was an Indian's ordered 2 plates of biryani per second.
Wow.
That is the So I don't understand like where this thing of looking down on people who eat meat stems from, because you know there's a lot of people in privilege who eat meat, but there's a lot of people who are not as privileged who don't eat. Eat meat, right?
Let's call it out for what it is. In India especially, there is a caste angle that cannot be denied. Vegetarianism at one point was incredibly privileged to like live the lifestyle. Like it was just easier to eat meat. Now you won't be eating your processed chicken and stuff.
Yeah.
But it was just easier to fill your stomach with meat. So I mean, obviously, the roots are there.
I think I read this in India Forum, but they said that meat eaters and food insecure people make up the majority of the Indian population. And sometimes these two groups overlap when it is people who are not in privilege. And, you know, bans on meat and stuff puts people's day-to-day food at risk, especially if they're already food insecure. And that brings me to like what we just saw a couple of weeks ago for Navratri. Obviously, there's a whole caste angle, but the religious polarization that has taken over meat is insane, because municipal officials in both Delhi and Uttar Pradesh were ordering meat shops to be shut down or to be moved outside city limits for the entire 9-day duration, despite the fact that the state governments did not issue any orders of that sort. And there's this whole thing about, you know, vandalism that happened in these 9 days. Boards were taken down. People were beat up. There was outrage over halal, which is a completely different conversation, I suppose. But we can't, again, it's very separate from like the vegan identity of the West, right?
The politics of meat and vegetarianism in India is so different from what it is in the West. I really want to know what it will, like what these impossible meat and what these plant-based meats will, like that kind of, how is that going to play out in Indian audiences?
In the Indian market, right?
Yeah. I mean, soya chaap is one thing, but bringing in plant-based meat is completely different. And it's so interesting because there, being a vegan is just one part of your identity. Here, you know, people will relate your food to your status, your honor to the...
And veganism is a choice.
Yeah.
You're not born vegan.
Correct. That is actually an...
You know? Yeah. Unless you're born in a vegan family, but like...
It isn't still as much about purity and pollution as much as the other politics that I mentioned in the beginning, right?
Of course.
Which is where... Which again, now Moon Burger seems to be wanting to move away from even that minimum amounts of politics.
Yeah. Oh my God, that, why do people hate vegans so much? You must check out that long read. The kinds of reasons people have of hating vegans is just, it's...
But have you guys ever had encounters with pushy vegans before?
Pushy vegans? Not really, no.
I have vegan friends, but they're not the pushy kind.
I once for work had to interview somebody who's running this like vegan organization. Like they're completely plant-based, and I am a regular meat eater. I called her up and I was talking to her. At the end of the conversation, she goes, "Hey, are you vegan or vegetarian?" No non-vegetarian option at all. So I felt judgment already coming on. So I said, I did not mention that I was eating meat. I said, you know, I'm vegetarian, and, you know, in that almost the same kind of way. And she said, think about going vegan. It's good for you. It's this, it's that. And mind you, this is after like a half an hour interview about why she is vegan and why that organization is doing what it's doing. So, I mean, I might relate to that long read somewhere.
Yes. It was relatable also. I'm not saying that it comes out of nowhere. It's not not coming out of nowhere. It is definitely very much there.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, personally, I don't think you can separate the politics out of. It's a marketing gimmick at best. Anyway, on that note, we come to the end of this segment. We will be right back after a short break. You're listening to Press Decode on the IVM Podcast Network. Welcome back to Press Decode on the IVM Podcast Network. It's time for our final segment this week, Roast or Toast. Yep, I once again have a least fave item. Clearly, the beginning of the year of me and very oh-so-optimistic Sarah is behind me. For some context before I get into the item, Vinod Rai used to be the chairman of the Committee of Administrators of the BCCI. Just to show you that this man was pretty much up there when it came to all things cricket. Now, with that out of the way, Rai was recently interviewed by The Week, and here's what he had to say about the state of women's cricket in India until 2006. Here's a quote. I was aghast to know that men's uniforms were being cut up and restitched for women players. I had to ring up Nike and tell them that this was not on and that their design would be different.
Wow.
It took a call. It took someone to reveal this so many years later. This was norm. And I don't know. I don't think there is much else to say except for the fact that I'm truly amazed at how the world somehow manages to find new and novel ways to show women that they truly couldn't give half a shit about equality, come what may, and despite any and all achievements that you may show. If you are still enraged, I do shamelessly suggest that you listen to our older prod from earlier this month where we decoded just how bad the state of women's cricket is in this country. Yeah, that's all I have to say, honestly.
Why do you put me in these situations, Sarah?
Hey, we decided
I have a fave item. I have a fave item, but I don't know how to switch so quickly.
Okay, I'll tell you what. This is a choice that we made of you will like tone down all my pessimism with happier things. So you're doing good.
I have a little bit of a happy thing. So this man, Kevin Burling, he was an employee at a US company and he suffered from anxiety and stress disorders. And his birthday was approaching in 2019. So he told his manager that he didn't want a birthday party at office because it might trigger him. But his office threw him a party anyway. And so he left and he went and sat in his car. And the next day, he was questioned for his behavior. He was accused of stealing his co-worker's joy and being a little girl.
I am so enraged right now.
This gave him a second panic attack. And then the company fired him on concerns of workplace safety. So he sued them. And this is the good part. He won a $450,000 judgment. Because this is what his lawyer said. Assuming that people with mental health issues are dangerous, without any evidence of any violent behavior, is discriminatory. So it was a good day for mental health. Heck, that's my
favorite
item.
That is actually a great item.
Yes.
So mine is the most frivolous of the lot. There's this Thai rapper who recently made history, call back to Coachella. But this is a 19-year-old rapper who was one of the acts at Coachella. And she was the first Thai artist, solo artist to perform at Coachella ever. But this is not why she made waves. Between her set, she took out like this Tupperware box and started eating dessert on stage and then proceeded to continue rapping, which is how it is insane to me that a person can rap and eat at the same time. And I'm super impressed. The Thai government also was apparently, because she was eating this Thai dessert called mango sticky rice, which is amazing if you haven't tried it. The Director General of Thailand's Department of Cultural Promotion, number one, accurately called it a power move. And number two, said that the dish will nominate the dish on the UNESCO proposal to be recognized as part of Thailand's intangible cultural heritage. And after that performance, sales of the mango rice have jumped all over the world, not just in Thailand.
Mm.
So true girl boss behavior.
Good. I was just saying, I was just going back to my loyally traditional cultural expression recognition. Leave it. It's fine.
I was just going to say, this is a girl boss that I can stand behind.
Correct.
And that was our show this week. Thank you so much for joining us on Press Decodes. You can catch us every Thursday on the IVM Podcast Network. And guys, please remember, don't let the news give you the blues.